Our next speaker this afternoon hails from the Netherlands originally, now based in Edinburgh as a founding member of Grossmax. The subject of his talk is the art of the artifact, or the cult of the cultivar. And please join me in welcoming Elko Hoefman.
Can the lights bit down? Well, exciting day. I must say, I normally don't like conferences like this. I get bored stiff. But not today, and that really excites me to see a range of colleagues all over the world actually emerging from these small-scale products, you know, like the garden festivals, but still you're up to something new and exciting, and I'm especially impressed that what I saw today of those small projects becoming big urbanistic propositions as well. And it's a bit like in the 70s when landscape architecture was pretty dour and nearly at its dead end in this country. I think the inspiration came from land art and people like Robert Smith and others. But here I think what we saw today is really quite important. And it's a pity that the audience are actually garden architects. I think the audience should be politicians, architects, urbanists. Tonight there's a little duo by Boris Johnson in which he reveals his new policy on architecture. And I got an invite, and it says you know you only can take yourself, but I would love to take the whole audience. And because if you got those speakers of today working in London, that would be fantastic. I'm very sorry you missed the first speaker of today. I met him. He was my taxi driver. And he asked me what I was going to do. He asked me, I was going to the Tate. He said, which Tate? I said, the old Tate is good because the new Tate is rubbish. And he asked me if I was working at the Tate. I said, no, I'm going to give a talk on gardens. And I said, it's pretty difficult for me because we don't do gardens, so I don't know how to do this talk. But he started to reveal, his knowledge about garden design, and it was amazing. You know, he talked for half an hour about his own garden. He got a summer house, it's called the West Wing. And not only that, he started to show the pictures of his garden on his mobile phone. And sorry about the previous speakers, which I did give the compliment, but that taxi driver was fantastic. So again, he should go to Boris Johnson tonight. Another thing was, I don't like the word conceptual garden, by the way. I think that's not at all kind of giving the kind of feel for what we're talking about. It's something much more serious and much more fundamental. I was very impressed that, the speakers from Australia are really representing Australia. Or Canada, it's really rooted in Canada. Or the memories from Vietnam shining through. So there's something more goes on here. So I have to talk about my background, which is the Netherlands. And this first painting is by Ruysdael. I saw it 2 years ago at the Academy in London here, and I suddenly felt homesick. And I think it's to do with the sky and the light. It's actually the town of Haarlem, the town I used to live in before I started to live in Scotland. And what I really like about this painting is how the landscape and the townscape are completely intertwined. The landscape is completely a man-made product. These are fields of bleaching the linen. It's nearly like an abstract painting. And the landscape is one construct. It's one man-made construct. And of course, fantastic how the church are punctuating the horizon, the flat horizon. And of course, there's a good reason, because we are below sea level. So if you are about 8 meters below sea level, you truly have to believe in God. Or you have to be an optimist. And I think that optimism is very much a product of that Dutch landscape. This is one of those churches, the St. Barthold Church. So we're zooming in and we're entering the church which you saw on the horizon. And again, this is all about light and minimalism. This is, of course, Protestant church. But still quite humane as well. Look at the doggy, the child, the beautiful mobile furniture. And this is another painting, and that's the church on the outside. And it's a civic space between the church and the town hall. And the reason why I'm showing you all of this, because that kind of sequence coming from the countryside through the city and the civic nature of the city all the way down to architecture, that's my profession of being a landscape architect, that full sequence of operations. Again, this morning we heard the story about functionalism and trying to escape functionalism. And it's a bit part of my story. Holland is so overwhelmingly man-made and sets a kind of straitjacket as well that I really felt I had to escape. And I was getting very much interested by the sublime, the whole notions about that landscape could be philosophy, a landscape could become terror, kind of idea that there is a world beyond the Dutch landscape. It was quite interesting. Only a week ago, I did give a lecture in the Netherlands, and I had to review my own education at Wageningen University. And I told them, I said, you did give a very good course in landscape architecture, but when I left the country, I had to throw the whole script away because, you know, it's written for the Dutch landscape, which is completely atypical. I moved to Edinburgh, to this fantastic city. The new town in the foreground, the old town in the background, Arthur's Seat, this big lump of wilderness in the center of town. Fantastic city. I've never built a project in this town as yet. Somebody asked me, why haven't you built a project in your own town? I say, because I'm an animal. And people say, what do you mean you're an animal? I said, well, an animal never shit in its own nest. Always, you know, that's why more projects exist in London, you know. I did a project. This is the only project I did for the town. It's actually a study. It's called Old Town, New Town, No Town. And we kind of were inspired by the old picture books, the tour guides of Edinburgh, and we kind of made a contemporary version mixing the old and the new. And this is Arthur's Seat, which I showed you in that aerial photograph. And for me, it's fascinating, you know, coming from Holland, that you have a lump of wilderness at the center of a city. That's a fantastic concept. And the idea for this project was, and it's owned by the Queen, it was even more sublime. You know, this is owned by the Queen. Because it's owned by the Queen, it's in pristine condition, you know? No suburbanizations, you know, no kind of delusion. And but the rest of Scotland is, of course, one big suburbia these days. So I think this is the last remaining wilderness in the center of town. And our project was about reinstating the true wilderness right in the heart of Edinburgh. So we are going to reintroduce, at least in our fantasy, the extinct animals like the wolves and the bears, right bang in the center of town. You're starting to understand why we have a little walk in Scotland. This is the Scottish Parliament. This is overtaken by nature. But we also went to the suburbs, and I really had a shock. I didn't know in Holland, where everybody's middle class, that in Britain you still have working class and upper class. And therefore also really, really bad areas. You all know the film Trainspotting, and tough. Then, of course, you've got the kind of wimpy housing, rubber stamped on the outskirts, creeping into the Greenbelt. It's actually quite a good idea. I quite like this kind of mortgage crisis, the credit crunch, because it stops maybe development like this, and maybe we have some time to review it. And this is a dream I always had, to have a, you know. It's really sad about Britain that they kind of stopped fox hunting, because I think foxes are not stupid, by the way. Foxes don't live in the countryside. Foxes live in suburbia. And I love to do a suburban fox hunt, you know, jumping over the B&Q fences, you know, jumping over the city bypass, hunting that little fox once a year. The early days in the Gross Max practice, we didn't have any work, and that was fantastic. The idea of having no work is ideal. If the telephone was ringing, that was a really great event. Once we had a fax, had a notepaper of Herzog de Meuron, which at that time were my heroes in architecture, and we threw it away in a dustbin because we thought it was a hoax. many years later, it turned out it actually was a real invite to work on one of their products, so we kind of delayed our career for a couple of years then. But what we did do is we were writing manifestos, and this was one of our early manifestos in which we trying to make a link between what we call the heydays of the British landscape architecture, the times when the landscape was still a testing ground for new ideas. It was a strong philosophical discourse, debate, the cult of the cultivar, the art of the artifact. And in comparison, what happens in the last century was actually quite the opposite. Landscape, landscape turned into environment, a delicate green tissue turned into a monstrous green blanket. We were inspired by the Surrealists. This is a group around Anne de Breton who rediscovered some of the Folly Gardens in the outskirts of Paris. We were inspired by this the collages like this, like by Max Ernst, the idea that landscape could be erotic, could be very sensual. We were dreaming about making gardens in which we would be overwhelmed by nature. This is a garden with only got plants with the Latin name Gigantium. So Lydium Gigantium, Gunnera Gigantium. So we would be overwhelmed. I haven't built this garden yet. I still want to do this. The wonders of nature. And again, one of our early statements when we were all a bit more obnoxious and in our adolescent states of our career in landscape architecture. But I think there is something still there. It's about refining layers in the landscape. And I think a lot of my colleagues today actually were doing that. And you have to be sharp, like Miss Marple. And you have to be seductive, like Mata Hari. So two of my heroes. This is actually not Miss Marple, but I would like to cast her for Miss Marple. Because look at that hat. I mean, we have seen some good projects today, but not as good as that hat. Quickly, some range of images, because images are actually quite important in our work. It's unashamedly, we are into visual delight. We think the world is too much look-alike. It all works about intensifying visual experience. Sometimes it means we're very extrovert and hedonistic. Sometimes it means we're very introvert and sometimes even minimal. But it is about that experience of landscape. A lot of the work we do is competitions. That's how we get our work. This is a competition which we luckily lost, because we lost against Gustafsson, which we saw this morning, this kind of project with Ken Livingston in a meeting with me once called an open sewer, which is maybe a bit mean. I actually quite like it. But of course, that project has caused that office a lot of problems. It literally had cost them a lot of work, and it's only now that they're kind of completely reviving that. But then for 5 years, they had less work because of that project. We lost the competition because we put Prince Charles as a silky little boy in a pink shirt, like a little closet, and it wasn't being appreciated. Projects. This is an early sketch for a project we did in Birmingham. A lot of our work tends to be urban squares. And I try to kind of, it's a bit like being in Stalinistic times, that you kind of wipe things out of your history. Today, I'm wiping out our squares, and we'll concentrate more on the green products. We work a lot with architects, especially with Zaha Hadid. This is a project below the Vesuvius volcano for a new railway station. This is a project which we did about 8 years ago. It's very close to the Olympics. And because it's close to the Olympics, we just got a phone call that maybe there's now money to do this project. This is a neighborhood park built around sports facilities for this neighborhood. We revisit Common Old New Town and wrote a manifesto about old town, new nature. Yes, we have done competitions for garden festivals, but we never won them. Maybe because in this particular project, we made the motorway the garden festival and left the site for itself on its own device. This is a project about climate change. It's called Global Warming, Local Freezing. It's a very simple proposition that in order to counterattack global warming, we'll all have to do a bit of local freezing. This is a nuclear-powered iceberg in front of Dunbar power station. It works a bit like a fridge. If you cool something down, you also generate heat. The heat is being repumped into lagoons in an old quarry, cement work quarries. Because of the lime, the water will become very blue. And so we've got a kind of climate interchange, the hot and the cold. And of course, this is tongue-in-cheek, but we could find, on the real side, you find fossils on the coast, which shows that this was once a tropical beach. And of course, the landscape here is molded by the ice. So it's quite fascinating that climate has always changed. Imagine climate would not change. I would be really worried. The other thing about climate change is people really, you know, actively seek climate change. You know, that's the main reason we go on holiday. You know, that's why we go on winter sport. You know, and we go to the beach in the summer. We like climate change. Sometimes the work is on a large scale. These are propositions for regional landscapes in Germany for the old coal works. And very recently, we finished a study for the whole of the Dead Sea coastline for the Jordanese government. And this was fantastic because the whole world talks about level of sea level rise. And this is the only project where we could talk about the problem of shrinking sea level, because the Dead Sea is actually sinking or shrinking with about a meter a year. It's really a big problem. Right, some more ideas about planning, because yes, I know we talk about gardens, but I truly believe that the gardens could be used as experiments of how to plan cities. And that's why I was very excited today to listen to some of my colleagues. I'm not the first person who said this. Laugier already wrote this in the 17th century, that everybody who's capable of designing a garden can design a city. Gudolf Korb, fantastic architect, disastrous town planner. One of the fantastic statements, which, you know, if you really take this serious, that the materials of city planning are sky, scape, or space, trees, steel, and cement in that order and that hierarchy, then I truly believe we can call ourselves, by means of those first three, sky, space, and trees, we can really call ourselves urbanists and town planners. But this was the reality. This is not Korb, but Hebelsmeyer, you know, but where are the trees? And this is a build project, and God knows where it is. I don't know where it is. It doesn't matter, the whole part of that. It really looks like this, being built 60 years later. And the proud architect. So yes, this notion about city and city planning. This was La Ville Radieuse by Korb. And this is a project which of Zaha Hadid, which we work with. And I like this idea that organic notions about growth and shape really can influence the new way of how we're going to plan our cities. Two photographs by the German photographer Thomas Struss. I like not so much the difference. I like what those images have in common. I think the city is an urban jungle, and I think even the jungle is affected by man, is actually an artificial product as well as anything else. We often in our office borrow language from the world of ecology and superimpose it on the world of urbanism. So for example, if you have a piece of wasteland, the first vegetation which grows on that wasteland is called pioneer vegetation. And over time, the pioneer vegetation becomes more complex, both spatially, as in species biodiversity, until you reach a climax vegetation. I think it's the same you can talk about cities. I mean, all those buildings, you can see the different ages and the different growths to the light. We can talk about pioneer urbanization and even climax urbanization. I think ecology is a brilliant way of analyzing cities. A beautiful plan made by Sir Abercrombie in 1946 to rebuild London after the war. But I really like this drawing because it shows the city as an organism. You know, we all know that London is about a conglomerate of villages. And all those villages, all those patches interact. They all have their own nucleus and they kind of exchange information at the ends. And I think it's very similar in a way how biology operates. And that's for me about ecology. Ecology is not about woolly jumpers and, you know, wooden clocks. It's about kind of high-tech understanding about the natural world. We like the city to see the cities as a network. This is, of course, an image by Constant, who was part of the Situationist in the 50s and early 60s. The city as a network, this is not a plan for a city, this is a biological diagram, but it could be the beginning of a beautiful city. And again, still having no work, writing manifestos, dreaming about. And this is actually quite important for me. I mean, in this country, we're obsessed about nature conservation. And I think it's much more interesting to talk about nature activation. How can we activate nature? And that's really taking place in Holland on a big scale right now. I'm going to show you first our best product, so it's done and over with. We can go straight into the drinks or into the debate. This is a product which we didn't design. We actually didn't do anything. We just found it and documented it. I don't know if we can call it our own product. It's just around the corner where I live in Scotland. And the product is about those cubes. Those cubes is beautifully following an undulating line in the landscape. It's like a piece of land art. However, the story is slightly different. Those cubes were there as an act of warfare. They were there to keep the Germans out, which is not a bad idea, except, of course, that the Germans had aeroplanes and other things. No, Speer landed. Was it Speer? Yeah, who did escape? Yeah, Speer landed in Scotland. Anyway, a beautiful product. But look what's happening on top of those cubes. And this, I showed this last year at the garden conference in Vienna. And it did say the same story. We didn't do the product, we just found it, we just documented. And I still got those questions. How did you do it? What are the plants you selected? No, we didn't do anything. This is nature. This is seeds dropping seeds and wind blowing sand. And you got this beautiful juxtaposition of these concrete blocks of warfare and the fragility of nature colonizing the top. It's a present, you know. It's fantastic. I cannot do better. I nearly give up to be a landscape architect because it was all done before. And for me, it's a kind of manifesto project. It's about how nature sits on top of the man-made product. And look at this. This is like a Japanese Zen garden. Oh, no. It's fantastic. And then suddenly it started to crack up. And also, this is also funny. I was talking at the RES conference with the big grand Peter Eisenman was there. And I had so fun. I was so happy Peter Eisenman was there. Because you know the Jewish memorial in Berlin. Which, by the way, is cracking up. The concrete got little cracks. I hope that those little seats will, you know. Anyway. This is like the Jewish memorial. I showed this to Peter Eisenman. I said, it's done before, you know. As a good, you know, British-German collaboration. A product. This was our first product in Japan. And this was one of those strange days. We got another fax in, and this time we took it serious, although the English was completely broken, and said, "Come, please come to Japan, to this Museum of Modern Art, and design a garden outside our gallery, freestanding gallery in the gardens of the museum." And we thought, my gosh, who dares to design a garden in Japan? You know, don't touch it. And also, we didn't have any budget, we didn't have any side photographs or any stuff. So the end of the story is all what we did is we're actually designing the windows of the gallery by an abstract print of woodland. So you get this kind of strange feeling of what's real, what is not real, and the light falling through that space. Funny enough, I mean, I was probably more modest those days because I said, who dares to design a garden in Japan? But we were visited only 3 weeks ago by a group of Japanese monks. And they came to us because Pete Audolf advised them to come to us. And the reason why they came is because their statement is they want us to do a project, Pete Audolf and myself, Grossmax, in Japan because there has been no innovation in Japanese garden architecture over the last 150 years. And, quotation, monk. So off we go. I discovered actually the site of those for this garden is 120 hectares, bought for £660 million from it's a former Nissan car factory in the outskirts of Tokyo, overlooking the Mount Fuji. An early project, Highland project in Rotterdam, before the Highland project in New York, and this was a study for Rotterdam Cultural Capital of Europe 2001. And here the idea was, how can we use that railway line for public space? And can we do a public project on top of the former railway station in the shape of a vertical glass house, would kind of utilize the Dutch techniques of, you all know those big tomatoes you buy in the supermarkets, you know, those big tasteless tomatoes. If you cannot do it with tomatoes, you can do it with anything. So we wanted to use the Dutch kind of Jekyll and Hyde techniques of horticulture, and making really, really gigantic, monstrous plants, organic orgy of orchids, we call it, packed in this glass house. And there would be light sources inside the glass house, which will be movable and reflect gigantic shadows on the outer skin of the glass house. And inside, you would be completely overwhelmed and seduced by the perfume of those flowers. It would be, you know, a really like an organic orgy. And the whole thing would act as a belvedere overlooking the city of Rotterdam. And that became part of a project in which, along the railway line, we were designing a series of parks and squares, sometimes making references to the old railway lines, like the signal boxes. And in order to make this railway line, which is a listed monument in the Netherlands because it's the first use of concrete. And when they made that elevated railway line, they really had to fight against the landscape because it's all peat and, you know, kind of soft soil here. And in order to build it, they had to commission the biggest geological cross-sections in the Netherlands ever being produced, you know, kind of a 30-mile-long cross-section about the soil conditions. We found those original drawings, and we flipped them on their sides, and that became the plan or the abstraction of the landscape on top of the railway line. And we used or proposed to use the different soil types like peat, clay, sandy soil, in order to generate those patterns. A project, again, I'm only showing projects we lose. We're not totally losers, sometimes we win. But this is, we won here the runner-up prize for a big park in Berlin. A fantastic site. It's 60 hectares, right bang on the border between East and West Berlin. So this landscape, this old railway line was being cut off during the Cold War. And nature took over. You got fantastic regenerated woodlands, a really beautiful site. And this was our proposition. Quite simple. It's about celebrating the woodlands, being inspired by the flow of the former railway lines, creating a large expanse of meadows and a series of experimental gardens, but on a scale of 60 hectares right bang in the center. And we like this notion. It's a bit like this Thomas Truss photograph, that on one hand, it's about hardcore nature. In this case, elevated walkways with shoots to the regenerated woodland. But also really celebrating the city on the edge of that park as well. So you've got the full contrast, the full sequence of events. That project didn't happen, but funny enough, sometimes you do projects and they lead to other projects. We've recently been commissioned to do a park on top of elevated railway lines here in the center of London at Bishopgate. So, and these are some of the very early drawings of that project. Right, this is an art project we won. It's called Garden for a Plant Collector. And this I'm always dreaming to make strange gardens of plants. And I'm very inspired. My little Bible is a small little book. And the book is called, translated, is called Against Nature. It's a novel. It's a fantastic decadent novel of the 1880s, written by Haussmann, Franz decadent author. And in this book, the protagonist, Eisenstein, he has all kind of compulsive behavior. And each chapter is about one of those compulsive behaviors. And in one chapter, he started to collect plants. And but all the plants he selected are real plants, but they look artificial. And they either smell of death, or they look like sexual organs. They're completely, the nature on its most grotesque. But I did my homework and went to the botanic gardens and went to the library, and all those plants and Latin names are real plants. So I wanted to make this glass house with this most weird plant connection of all those grotesque plants. So that was the start of the project. And in order, because, you know, we have to be conceptual, as we have heard today, so we had to find a kind of meaning and something more. We also wanted to make contemporary interpretation of grotesque plants. And we found a little article in the newspaper that you could make plants grow glow in the dark, and they use it for scientific research because they can use it to see how viruses move to living plant tissue without killing the plant itself. And we thought, if you can do that in the name of science, you can do it in the name of art as well. So we want to have these glowing glasshouses, glowing plants. And the way how you do that is taking the tissue of a jellyfish and put that into the tissue of the plant. Fantastic. You know, mixing animal and plant to make plants glow in the dark. And the first plant they used it was the tobacco plant, Nicotina. And this project is in Glasgow, and Glasgow became famous because of the tobacco trade. So we thought, let's make glowing tobacco plants. We discovered some artist has been there before. This is a real artist who made glowing rabbits. So that was the idea. Don't worry, the project is built, but not in its present format, because the client got cold feet. They thought that kind of activist would smash the glasshouse. So yes, we did build a glasshouse, not this one, a bit more Mishan. The idea, and we kind of like the glasshouse to be mysterious, the kind of things as a secret experiment hidden in the woodlands. And here is the first room that actually became built in a more kind of slightly more modest and slightly more acceptable way. It still is a very strange experiment of plants, mainly ferns and tree ferns, underneath different colored glass. Another garden project. This is a small project, not much money, but it did give us some satisfaction because the project was about an old hospital, and the brief was to make a temporary garden for the case that the hospital would be demolished and decommissioned. And we thought it's pretty good because normally architects come along and they start to destroy a landscape in order to build a building. So to do the other way around, to destroy a building in order to create a landscape, kind of felt like sweet revenge. So off we went. And because we were part of the demolition of the hospital, we could kind of, although it was a nightmare project, because you never know what's starting to happen if you start to demolish some building with all the kind of old cellars and all kind of other things, we were quite keen on in keeping artifacts of the old building, like the old portico and certain walls and other conditions, to integrate that into our new temporary garden. And this is only just after building of the garden. So a very simple product. It's about, this image was quite good. I mean, when I presented this to the big principal of this university, they had a half-hour discussion about the girl. Because the girl was seen as too sexy for the image of the university. So we were kindly asked in official writing to remove the girl from the image. And we replaced the girl by a kind of spotty young boy with very thick glasses. And somehow that was okay. That somehow. So much for Scottish education. Very steep side, and we're kind of using the steepness of the side to create a series of terraces, capturing the south-facing slope and creating a belvedere overlooking the city of Glasgow. The inspiration, the building of the project. Here we started to recycle. We broke down the stonework of the hospital and that being recycled in those gabion walls. So it's a kind of mixture of old and new. Meant to be a temporary garden, but people like it now very much, and it's now there to stay. A strange rock garden, which we use the old kind of slightly more intriguing pieces of the hospital combined with new planting. And in the summer, it's often being used as open air cinema. Another park we did here in London, next to the City Hall, And that's his first collaboration with Piet Oudolf. And it's fantastic to know Piet, because he's, you know, he's one of the most amazing plantsmen in the world. Yes, he did. He was being mentioned this morning because he worked with field operation on this elevated railway line in New York. But we got him actually his first public project in Britain, which is not easy because we have some problems in getting the right maintenance staff, and the fact it's public, it is slightly more onerous than. But the reason why we could do it, by the way, is, and that's, I'm quite proud about that, is as part of the design of this park, we convinced the client to take the park away from this council, Southwark Council, and put it in a trust. And because it's put in a trust, that all the money which is generated by the park, which is quite a lot of money because those fields are being rented out for all kind of advertisements, which generate a hell of a lot of money, and that's being repumped in the maintenance of this particular park. So the trust was quite a nice idea. It's a very simple proposition. It's a more intimate neighborhood garden which opens up to a series of terraced fields and a kind of States-like setting facing the River Thames to show what the project really is about. It's the skyline of London to be seen from this part. And sometimes landscape, I have no problem with that landscape. I mean, sometimes I have to admit as well, even flicking to Tim's book, is this bit of an overdose of ideas and colors. And sometimes, actually, I think there's also a reason sometimes to be quite restrained and just let people occupy space and just provide very simple means in order to allow that to happen. The construction of the garden, which we redesigned the layout, but the planting is by Piet Oudolf. And of course, this is only the first growing season, so we really need more time to let it all come to its full plan. Another slightly odd project. It's a project for this blank gable wall. This is very close to the park, but not related. It's a separate commission, an art commission, to do a project against that blank gable wall. And what do you do? We work together with Mark Dayon, a very famous American artist, who once did a beautiful project about the old Tate and the new Tate. He had an archaeological dig in front of here, in front of the foreshore of the River Thames. And he did a comparison study at the New Tate, and that became a cabinet of curiosities. Fantastic project. So we got him involved in this project. And this is one of those projects, I have to admit, that it took only 10 seconds to make the concept. That's all we needed. And it took us about 3 years to build it, to get permission, to find the money, to build the project. But the whole idea was being born in, you know, no farting around, 10 seconds. And the idea was to use this idea of the geometry of fire escapes to create a structure for what could become a vertical garden. And we quite like this kind of notion of this kind of nearly Piranesi type of weird scape of those layering. And then the idea that that could become a vertical garden, right bang in the center of London. These are some of the drawings, and fantastic. As an artist, you can do everything, because I actually think that those drawings are quite crude, but they're so sweet and actually worth a hell of a lot of money that the artist waived his fee because he said, well, that's okay, I'm making my money by selling the drawings. But it's nice, and for us, interesting to collaborate, because we kind of draw in a different way. But that strange combination of translating those ideas in a more computer-generated design and more conceptual diagrams about this vertical ecosystem. And here are image routes we really use to sell and to kind of promote the product. It's just being built, only just. It's literally last week. So obviously all the plant has to grow and it has to kind of evolve over the coming years. but the basic frame is there to happen. Another garden, and I mean, these are gardens, but of course they're not private gardens, so maybe the word garden is the wrong word. But this is a garden you can see in if you dare, because it's in Liverpool. It's a long way from London to Liverpool. Not only that, it's in a really bad part of Liverpool. But a lovely project, which we work very closely with the local residents to make it happen. Because, like any cultural capital city, they always got a bad conscience. You know, they're having big concerts and big exhibitions in the center of town, so they do little token projects in the outskirts. And this group of clients actually were more interested in the garden than in an art piece, so they commissioned us, a set of artists, to do the project. And this is the Rotunda College. This is a learning institution for lifelong learning for people who never had the opportunity and could do classes in all kinds of things in this school. But of course, look at the state and look. But also, so it was really quite rewarding to make a community garden to really act as a manifesto of how to occupy space. And put the neighborhood on the map and show that positive action could be taken. We were very inspired by this beautiful folly garden in the outskirts of Paris, the same garden being rediscovered by André Breton, partly because he found a beautiful group of poplar trees on the site, which looks like this isle, the island of poplars in which Rousseau was being buried. And I always very much liked that folly of this column. And the more you think about it, the Greek column is, of course, derives from plant growth. This is, you know, not very much different than a kind of manifestation of the growth of plants. So we were intriguing of reinstating that folly in a contemporary way in this context, and partly because the school is called the Rotunda, and of course this shape is the Rotunda shape. And the idea of this kind of community gardens and punctuated by that folly. Dismantling the old folly, reinstating it in new materiality. The idea that this could be a hanging garden, and here we built it. And it's kind of intriguing display of real and artificial plants. Spot the difference. There are real ones and artificial ones, so you never know what you're looking at. And just to show that sometimes those projects lead to bigger projects, because this is a project we do right now with Future Systems in Bangkok. It's a really big beast of a building on what is the most expensive square meter price in Bangkok. It's a piece of land bought from the British Embassy. So they're cashing in. And we are involved in a series of gardens inside and on top of this building. But one of those gardens is a kind of floating garden in the central atrium, which is inspired by the shapes of the orchids. And it's kind of mysteriously floating around, surrounded by cloud of artificial mist. These are trays of moss. This can be seen from different angles, from different parts of the building. Finally, I just go back to the Netherlands, because I must say, I kind of escaped the Netherlands. I didn't feel at ease in the Netherlands. Partly, by the way, because there are bloody good landscape architects in Holland. You know, there's an overdose of good landscape architects. So I thought, you know, there's no reason for me to do projects in Holland. But I must say, I'm now I feel a bit more confident. I think it's time to recapture the Netherlands. And we got a lovely project. Of course, I talked about the light. I talked about the Dutch creating their own landscape. It's interesting, on most paintings by Vermeer, you're seeing the map of the Netherlands displayed on the back. It's like a little coat, nearly, a kind of geographic disposition of the paintings in the Dutch landscapes. And of course, that landscape is still changing. and transforming. And, you know, it's a part of continuous debate. This goes on till its present day. That's that landscape, completely man-made. Now, this is a joke about Germans, but this is a good German, Josef Beuys, the artist. And he made a very intriguing comment about the Dutch landscape. Basically, he told the Dutch, you fucked it up, big time. And he got a fantastic, simple rationale. He said, you guys have done so much land reclamation in the Netherlands that you spoiled the liquid mirror. The water in your landscape acted as the mirror, and that's created all your beautiful paintings like Vermeer, Ruysdael, Rembrandt. And because, you know, during the 20th century, you speeded up the amount of land reclamation, you lost the mirror, and you have not produced any work of any interest in terms of its visual quality. Clever, but also very fascinating that how much, you know, even the art is derived from the landscape. So I'm intrigued by that. And now we got a project in what used to be the Zuiderzee is now the IJsselmeer. It's an island, or nearly an island, next to a museum. And it's a project with Piet Oudolf. And the brief is fantastic. The brief is very simple. The client asks us to design the most beautiful garden in Europe. He refused to give a budget. He refused to write a brief. We got a year of time to deliver the goods, and it's a couple of months ago before we launched this project. And for us, this project is all to do with light and how to catch the light and the Dutch conditions of light. Interestingly enough, we have seen quite a lot of reference to light today, even the light in France and other projects. And light is so fantastic about understanding the quality of a space. This is the project. It's the Zuiderzee Museum, and this is the kind of island or the peninsula of for this project. And I only can show you some early images of the project, which is a combination of planting of peat outdoors in strange landforms with cut on the edge from the land and the wetlands. Strange, mysterious pools of water. And towards the end of the project, a series of basins, all on slightly built in different conditions. So one will have peat, a soil, black peat. Other ones will have white seashells. They will have various depths. In order to, we would like to make a palette of the Dutch light reflecting in the water as part of the climate of this project. Right, and that was Grossmax.
Thanks very much, Elko. And can I just ask, we're going to do the Q&A session now, so can I just ask all of the designers to step on up onto the platform here, if you don't mind, and we'll start taking some questions. It's also a good moment. I know a couple of people have to go for trains, so please feel free if you need to do that, of course. Could I just also suggest, if anyone has got any questions for our afternoon speakers, could we take those first? Because we didn't have a chance for Q&A with them. So that's Andy Gowan, Xavier Perrault, Claude Cormier, and Elko Hoefman, who we've just heard, of course. Designers, can you come up, please? Thanks very much. So has anyone got any questions for the afternoon speakers, first of all? Perhaps it's all a dim, distant memory now. Okay, well, let's think about general questions then. There's a question just here. If you could just remember to say your name, and perhaps if you'd like to say who, if there's somebody on the panel you think might best answer it. But don't worry if not.
I'm Lorraine Johnson. I'm a garden designer. I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly who did the lipstick garden. It's a bit of a silly question. Did the trees move? Were they on little wheels?
No, the trees are not moving. They're just on a platform. And they weigh 1 ton each.
Ah. Okay.
They're made on a steel frame, wire mesh, and a gunite pool concrete type has been shooted on them. And they're earthquake proof. Public space.
And they're still there, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think there was a question right at the back. Lady on the back row.
Hi, Anthea Harrison. I've just wondered, do you all just do conceptual gardens now, or do you ever get, do people just ask you to do that because that's what you're known for, or do you ever get briefs for doing sort of more regular work, I guess, if I can describe it like that?
Does anyone get any regular work?
Well, I would say this is regular work. We can do any kind of work, I would say. But the commonality in all of the projects is that each of those projects has one single idea instead of having 10 ideas. There's just one that somehow takes into account all the issues that is around the project. So this is common practice.
Yes, I think that is, you know, one of the things of this, the disadvantages of this category, conceptualism. You know, these designers don't wander around saying, hello, I'm a conceptualist designer. That's not sort of how it works, I think, and nor how it should work. So I think it sort of comes naturally to these designers. So that's, I think, why they're a little nonplussed by the idea. There's a question just here.
Thank you. Britta von Schoenreich. It's a question following on from what you just said, Tim. This label of conceptual landscape architects or designers, some people obviously identify themselves with that. Others say this is a funny label. I think the positive side is definitely that we owe a lot of gratitude to Tim to have managed to get a panel of very talented and interesting designers together, and also he's generated much interest with that book. But at the same time, you know, we're in that book as well, and I think what sets the good designers aside from not so good ones is that they have a concept. And I think that applies to all of us who produce good work, because I can't think of a single good landscape scheme or garden that was born without a good design concept. And I just wondered whether the people in the panel would very briefly like to say something about this label.
Who would like to pick that up? Elko, would you mind just talking into their microphone? Could you? Oh, sorry, yeah. Yeah, no, it's fine.
I despise the label. I love the book, I love the speakers, but I despise the label because everything is a concept, and every good design is based on a concept. It's a beautiful exhibition right now in the Royal Palace in the Netherlands at Lo, which puts drawings throughout history. It goes back to 1400s of how landscape had been drawn as conceptual ideas. And so this idea of concept is too general. Everything has a good concept. And I completely agree with Brigitte that without a good concept, there is probably very little possibilities of a good design. But there is something else. I mean, I can even use the word, and this looks like a very strange word today, but take the word contextual. I think that most of the schemes we've seen today have been very intriguing about responding to context. I think what is different is that the context is changing. This is embracing the urban context, or it's embracing contemporary culture as context. But it's still very contextual work. This is not work. I hardly have seen any project today which was kind of just thrown onto the side. And that I found very intriguing. It's that actually there have been very specific projects. And but we have to find a better word. And
I would like to say something. I just learned a new word to pronounce it. Ambiguous, is it right?
Ambiguous.
Ambiguous, yeah. Because I think it's really important that it's not so, like, if there is a concept, it's not only that. There can be another interpretation, like your love for Dutch landscape and at the same time sort of confusion with, yeah. And like, for example, there is one project I want to do, but I don't know how to do it. But there is a place in south of Sweden, looks just like Holland, with there's this bay with shallow water, and it's beautiful light, and this rural landscape with cows and meadows, and just behind that is the nuclear power station with a forest. So it's like you see in the horizon, you see that these grayish colors, and it goes to the forest, and then it goes tuk 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 tuk, and it's almost like EKG, you know, for the heartbeat, those two things, and it's really beautiful. So I like the light. I just love this sight. It's really confusing.
just add quickly, because there's something confusing about your book as well. And no. What confuses me? I mean, it's not a criticism to the book, but
it's okay.
If you go. Landscape architecture has for a long time been a fair regional profession. I really could recognize the Danish landscape architecture. You know, they always had the oval, and when somebody dared to make an ellipse from the oval, that was like the Danish Revolution. You know, I would recognize the French landscape architecture. I mean, it was always about philosophy and the essence of the space. And I would recognize the Dutch landscape architecture, the British as well, in the heydays of Jellicoe, etc. Very distinctive regionalized profession. And what we're seeing now is this globalization and this kind of ambiguousness between a global culture and local culture. And I think that's a very intriguing thing, because if I flick to that book, on first instance, it's quite difficult to see who's whom and where's people coming from. And you get these hybrids from people from Vietnam being brought up in the United States and then rediscovering, and it's contemporary culture. I mean, we're working at the moment in 15 countries, more than we have people in the office. And we only can do that because we work with email, internet, EasyJet flights, city hopping, and things like that. So it's that kind of strange overlapping culture. But interestingly enough, most of the speakers today, they still were rooted in their country, from the Canadian farm till the Australian desert. So this, but yes, ambiguous nature is maybe.
But also that it's not necessarily one idea. It can be interpreted in different ways, and mean different things to different
That's
people.
That's quite interesting what you just said, because it doesn't. It's about being imbued with a landscape either from your childhood or through study. That to get a deep understanding of that, you can then go out and have a deep layered understanding of another place and another context and another set of narratives. That, and I think West Ada are really interesting in that way. That book, Mosaic, there must be about a 20-page essay on Dutch landscape. And they obviously have a very deep understanding about Dutch landscape, which is like you were talking about, your experience of Dutch landscape, that then allows you to work all over the world, because that sense of being imbued by light and landscape and culture allows you to work in other places in the world. So you don't have to keep creating the Dutch landscape all over the world.
True, funny enough, that I think that the really great West Ada stuff is still in Holland.
You do?
And I think their crap work is abroad.
That's my theory.
But like coming back to this concept, conceptual, like McDonald's, for example, it's a great concept because it works all over the world and everybody recognizes it. But what's the idea of McDonald's? It's to earn money and to sort of multiply the same thing everywhere. So maybe this is not so exciting idea. So it's just like what's the concept about?
That's a commercial concept also, yeah. Which is uniform across the world. It's also known as a brand. You know, so that's the link between branding and concept, I suppose.
So this is more like cultural concept, which is interesting.
Well, I guess what you create as designers are one-offs rather than industrial design, which is, you know, should be replicated thousands of times all over the world, as you say, for commercial ends. Now, I understand what Elko's saying about context. I mean, I suppose it seems to me that this work does rather transcend international boundaries. What's interesting to me is actually the festivals, things like Chaumont and Métis and so on, prove also not just that it's important that individuals express their own histories, if you like, through their work, but also that the places themselves where the festivals are held have such powerful atmospheres. I don't know how many of these shows people may have been to, but even if you compare Chaumont in France with Westonbirt in England, or Cornerstone in San Francisco, or Métis in Canada, several people have mentioned, they all have their own very specific atmosphere and rationale, and it's bound up with where they are and the people who run it. So, yeah, it kind of, you get away from that sense of nationalism, I think, quite quickly. And I think context in that sense is only partially about geography, much more about climate and site and personality and many other things, and history as well. It's all bound up with context. So I suppose where I'm going with that is it's almost as if context is synonymous with concept and on some occasions. But I do still think that conceptual is a better term than contextual. Next question. Oh, I've got two here. There's a gentleman in a purple shirt just here.
Thank you. Paul Davis, probably a rare architect here today in this audience, and something of a contextualist. I think what's been so impressive for me today is actually how rooted in context the work is. One of the things that's letting our profession down of architects these days is with globalization is you look at any of the magazines and you don't know where something is. It could be in St. Petersburg, it could be in Kuala Lumpur, it could be in Adelaide, because our profession has lost the will to live in certain respects. All it's concerned about is ego games. And I think as an outsider to this particular world, but one very much involved in urban design and public realm, it's fantastic to see the caliber of work that is rooted in an understanding, I think your point and Kate's point, through a deep understanding of place, then actually being able to go to another place and actually understand it and actually work in that place and not just export yourself in some commercial way. But very interestingly, only next door last week, I went to the opening of the new space in the middle of the University of the Arts campus next door, which actually has got a rather disappointing new public surface. And Anish Kapoor actually raised the point about the clarity of meaning that there perhaps was in public space in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, with clearly understood symbolisms about civic space and civic pride. It was a very interesting point that he was raising about the sort of need for a new symbolism. But I think, and I've been sort of posing that question to myself, it's a question to the panel, but already some of the answer seems to be coming out, that actually it's about understanding the place. But I'd rather hear from the panel.
Would anyone like to pick that up? Andy Xavier? Well, I think what you had to say was very interesting, and in a way we'll move on. I think there was a question on the row behind. There's a lady just behind you there. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm afraid I was going to go back to the earlier points. Carol Woodley. It was just about Britishness. It's great to have these people from all parts of the world, but I'm just wondering about the whole. Is there a whole in terms of British contribution to this area, really?
No, not really, no. I suppose the reasoning in choosing the fantastic speakers we have today, the rationale was to try to introduce people to this British audience who they may not have seen speak before, or you know, maybe whose work they may be unfamiliar with. So I suppose nominally Elko, coming from Edinburgh, is the British representative, although he isn't British. But that was the idea, was so that we could just introduce. There are in the book, I think there are five or six or seven people who are based in Britain, although nearly half, three or four of them actually are of different nationalities. So that was the idea.
We have a policy in our office, or a statement, is that we're kind of multinational in micro format, because we've got many different nationalities, but we kind of made that our kind of motto, and we want to be as humorous as the Brits, as rigorous as the Germans, and as experimental as the Dutch. That's what kind of written on our toilet.
Okay, next question. There's the lady here in grey, just in the middle of this row here. The mic's coming the other way.
Hello, I'm Sandra Ashton from Leeds Metropolitan University, and I just wanted to reassure everybody that I'm one of a number of staff who in first year, for instance, landscape architecture garden design students, they are fully immersed in sketching the landscape, understanding the landscape at different venues, very different venues. So the first part of their training, they are imbued with a sense of how to look at the landscape on different layers, from topography, history, vegetation. And then obviously through the years, that's built on the different skills. So it's something that's taught rigorously where I work. So those students are better able to work in different countries, different parts of this country. But as one lady said, we grow up and we're attached to our landscapes, and that's very deep, a deep intrinsic fact of being human.
Okay. Thanks. Question just behind you. Can you just pass the mic back? Thanks.
Thank you. Hugh Ryan is my name. I've got many questions, but the first thing I want to say is fantastic. You know, eight people here. I've gone to conferences all over the place, and I've never had such a fabulous day. So thank you very much. But conceptualism, I'm with Elko, I must admit, on this thing. The other term that I hate is contemporary, you know. But given the fact that you are all dealing with concepts, what about the retrofitting of concepts? You know, surely you work intuitively on a lot of your projects, and it's only afterwards when people like Tim come along and say, I know what you were trying to get at there. Do you think that sometimes the concept is retrofitted to the project?
Would anyone like to refute or or confess at this point?
Well, I don't think it's Kevin. I don't think it's so much retrofitting as sometimes you... Either yourself or other people you're collaborating with who are perhaps coming from other disciplines, you know, can tease out and recognise layers that perhaps you weren't able to, you know, explicitly describe in the very early stages. But, you know, when you think about it later on or somebody points it out to you, you have that sort of aha moment that, yes, it was sitting there somewhere in the subconscious, but... Now, hopefully we don't completely construct them, you know, from scratch afterwards. That would be wrong.
Thanks, Kevin. Any other questions? There's a lady in the middle here, in the green. I saw your back as well. It's coming that way, I think.
Thank you. Pamela Johnson again, I'm sorry. You've all talked about the challenge that you have of getting your clients to go along with your ideas. Do you, any of you, have any advice for us designers with more humble reputations? How do we persuade our clients to accept our ideas without them chipping away at our original concept?
When we went to do this Australian Garden, which was back in 1994, Kevin and I worked from home. We had done smaller projects that had mainly been for local councils, and our competition were all the really big firms. And we worked for weeks on our submission. We both brought the idea of prose and poetics into... convincing the client of the way that we would approach the project. And I was just talking to somebody during the break about the power of the written word, particularly when convincing clients to go in a certain direction. So
is it presentation? Is it how?
Present, yeah. We spend an enormous amount of time, and I think probably a lot of people here do, in competition mode, on presentation, and thinking about how to approach the project, and I suppose that the dirty word concept of...
Is it dirty now? We got to that stage.
Sorry, Tim.
It's like dirty realism, isn't it?
And also storytelling, I think, that idea of narrative. really helps people to become enthusiastic about it.
So it's presenting your, it's thinking about how you present your idea and your presentation of it as well.
Yeah, I found quite a lot of speakers here's graphics incredibly seductive.
Claude was wanting to get in.
I would say that a client that's, once you learn the importance of having a client and a good client, is fundamental. Mm-hmm. I think I'm at the point now that you're working in a relationship with the client, and somehow if they don't understand what you're doing, it's difficult for them to spend X amount of dollars. Or if you work with a true city council, you have to somehow make sure that they get what you're doing, because
I think I'm thinking about the domestic market, if you like.
But that's the same thing.
Yeah.
If your client understand what you're trying to do, then this is when the moment of the thing will happen.
So it's communication again.
It's totally communication, and instead of fighting, it's collaborating. And I think within the process, you have to leave a little room for them to be able to inject their sensibility within it, and then it becomes their thing. Yeah. So, and then it becomes a much more easier thing to build. So it's not about conflict, but it's about having a team, right?
I think that's absolutely true, yeah.
In all scale, from domestic to public scale.
And all I add to that, in my experience of interacting with the designers, is it's the other thing is you have to do it wholeheartedly. You can't go into it in some sort of half-hearted fashion, sort of try to bolt on a conceptualist notion. It has to sort of start and finish with that. So it is a matter rather of taking the plunge, I think. There's another question up at the back on this side. Yes, lady.
Hello. Kate, you spoke a bit about the process of how you come up with your ideas, of you sitting in a room and discussing things. But you're all under the pressures of everyday work and making projects actually happen and deadlines and clients and calls and emails. And I just would love to know a bit more about, from any of the others, about the actual process of giving yourself that space in order to actually come up with the original ideas and concepts.
Working methods. Does anyone want to reveal how they...
Well, I'll start. I think it's really hard. I think it's one of the challenges of running a practice of any size is trying to protect that space of reflection. I think one of the things that we do. I mean, we're lucky in our company. There's three directors, and we're very fortunate to have some very talented people working with us in the studio. But we also make a really concerted effort to involve people from outside the practice in projects. And I think everybody has spoken about collaboration with artists, sculptors, and people from a range of disciplines. And I think that's a really it's not only artistically a great thing to do, but it's also very sort of efficient in terms of the creative process, because you bring in people with totally different perspectives, and that can be extremely stimulating.
Also makes for really good parties.
Okay, well, speaking of parties, we're going to have a little one now. It's probably, all of us out there, it's probably time to wrap up. Before doing so, I just want to say a personal note of thanks to the trio of women sitting down here on the front row from the Society of Garden Designers, Jackie Herald, Annabelle Downs and Sarah Massey. Thank you for all your work and arranging that. Peter Thomas, the chair of the SGD, will just wrap up very quickly in a moment. And I just wanted, before that, just to say thank you again personally to all the designers who I will name: Andy Gow, Claude Cormier, Monica Gora, Elko Huffman, Kevin Taylor, Kate Cullerty, and Xavier Perrault.
I- I've been sitting there for the last half hour thinking, whatever I do, don't forget to thank Annabelle, Jackie, and Sarah, and the speakers. So that's left me a bit awash now. I would like to thank the Society of Garden Designers through them for driving this whole project forward. And of course, the kind workers of the Tate for keeping us all well fed and watered. I think the speakers were delivered on time, and everybody's had a fabulous time. So thank you to all involved there. And of course, thank you to Tim, who's taken this idea of is grasped this idea of conceptualism, which may be renamed contextualism perhaps at a later time, but still, he's taken it and he's used that thread to draw all of these people's work together for us to admire and be invigorated by and inspired by. And I think that, you know, we can continue arguing the toss about the names and things, but at the heart of it, we've got the meat. And certainly the concept behind today's talk has given us all the opportunity to, you know, reap the benefits of all of this. So I think that's a really good thing. And of course, our speakers, without whom we wouldn't have had a day, or Tim wouldn't have had a book, I guess, if there weren't people around like this. I'm sure we'll all go away with our own ideas about the fabulous work that we've seen. There are a few things that sort of stick in each of our minds. I suppose the big thing for me was hearing Monica sort of defining this idea of there being the artist and the designer, and at the heart the artist is solves a problem, but the designer solves a problem, and the artist asks a question. And I feel like we're all sort of somewhere enmeshed, somewhere along that line, moving backwards and forwards according to, you know, our natural abilities and the starting point, whether it's a practical project or something that's an installation. And I think that's certainly been extremely helpful for me to sort of think, well, yeah, it is okay to do these things outside and not have plants. And yes, it is okay to have, you know, environmental issues brought in, and you can sort of move backwards and forwards between them. So, and we've seen such a wonderful range of work here, I think, today that we'll all go away with, you know, bristling. It's difficult to say whether it's more invigorating or refreshing today, but it's certainly been inspiring. So big thank you to all the speakers again.